Live from the heart of Los Angeles, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright lights.
We have tonight's guest, writer, director, and documentary producer, Sean Monson.
Look at the night sky. Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Luis Oliart. I am Mark Lejeune, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
Calling on humanity to make the connection now. This is episode 754 of the Life Changes Show, and a very special one, if I might say so. We have gotten that title from our guest, who is a documentary filmmaker. It's the subtitle of his Earthlings film, and also the subtext, actually, of probably all of his films. And it really hit home with us, and calling on humanity to make the connection now. I'll tell you, I got a dose of it this morning as I was having an extremely busy morning with this and that, and it was back to back, and it just was nonstop. And then I got a call with our guest, and he helped me make a connection real fast by sharing what's important to him and what's obviously important in the work that he does, in the movies that he makes, and the integrity behind how he shared that just like brought me to now. And back to back almost, I talked to our guest, our performance guest, who I hadn't connected with at all. And within minutes, more of the same. And by the time I had conversations with those two, boy, I felt like we are making a connection. We made a connection. We are making a connection. The work that we're doing, whether it's through our producer, director, screenwriter, guest, making humanity take a look at subjects that we either haven't looked at before or in ways that we haven't, and the consciousness that goes into the music of our performance guests, I was happily blown away. I trust you will be too.
I'm really, really excited for tonight's show. I've known Sean for a longer time than I probably would like to admit, but with the people that we've come across in Life Changes, there's always an opportunity to look deeper into what someone's commitment is. And I don't know that I know many people that are more passionately and authentically committed to their mission than Sean is. And he has changed the game in so many ways by putting videos out that are hard to watch and hard to sit through because people are so easily look the other way. And but yet giving a voice to the voiceless through extreme creativity. And can't wait for the music from Luis as well.
And you know, Mark, thank you. That hit it right on the head. And that was also the thing, is that both of these guests have worked with so many celebrities on big stages, and their movies have done this, and the movies have won awards and gotten attention, yada yada. And our performance guest has been on some big stages with some big rock stars, and none of that was mentioned. The very first thing was straight to what we need to do right now to make this
humility
connection.
Humility and purpose.
For the good of humanity. Our guest is a writer, director, and producer of documentary films, including Earthlings and Unity, and so many more, and more are coming. We are so happy to have Sean Monson on the show. Welcome, Sean, and thank you.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen, for having me. Happy to be here.
You also focused me on a Buddhist teaching about change in thoughts, and please share.
Well, it's just, I'd read I'm not Buddhist, but I love the research. Maybe that's a default of being a documentarian. The research into, you know, this issue or that. And the Buddha once said that the greatest miracle in the world is to change a single thought. And if you break that down, that bears repeating, by the way. So the greatest, it's a big word, miracle, another big word in the world is to change a single thought. And when I heard that, I thought, oh, we're in trouble because of how identified we are with our thoughts, which many of which are taught or were taught as we were raised. So we come by them honestly, and then they become identities. And so, you made me think of it in something you said in your intro. In the film Unity, we had this phrase that comes up throughout the film, which says no separation based on form. No separation based on form. So what does that mean? It means, well, life is multitudinous in its expression. The way life expresses itself clearly is multitudinous. So it's birds, it's fish, it's mold, it's worms, it's people, it's crows, it's sharks, it's bacteria, right? So life is multitudinous in its expression. Okay, so what happens is we have preferences of expression. Some expressions we like or love, and even cultivate an attitude of compassion and love and empathy for, while in the same breath, we have an attitude of aggression toward other expressions of life that we don't like. And shining a light on that duality can be disquieting for viewers at first, but it really is very, very simple. It's something Joseph Campbell said, that the only truth is the truth that shatters. So, you know, we should be grateful to be shattered of our illusions, if you think about it. So that's kind of what I discovered through the power of documentary filmmaking, which is the nonfiction film. That's the definition. And particularly like with the previous film, Earthlings, which was how humanity uses animals for economic purposes. So it covers, you know, pets, food, clothing, entertainment, medical research, and so forth. And what you see here is you see an attitude of preference for some expressions and an attitude of aggression toward others. I just found that in the documentary medium, that was really odd, because when I did my first cut, we showed it to distributors and they said, you got to cut this out. And I thought, well, hang on a second. This is a non-fiction film. How much truth am I supposed to cut out of it? And that really got me on this, a deeper path of the truths that we like versus the absolute truths.
Speaking of getting on the path, you didn't set out per se to be a filmmaker. You didn't set out per se to make films at the beginning of all this per se, right?
Well, not documentaries. I mean, even as a kid, I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker. I think one of the first films I think I ever saw was 1 million BC, and I was a kid. And of course I had a crush on Raquel Welch, like everybody, you know, this beautiful cave woman. And then later at an early age, I saw Dr. Zhivago. I think I was 13. And here's this David Lean epic story of this Russian revolution and this love story, this love triangle. And it ripped me open. And then also I remember seeing, in a completely different context, I remember seeing at 10 years of age, Ridley Scott's Alien. And I think even at 10, which was quite horrifying, that movie, it's a scary movie. But I remember at the end, there's credits. And I'm just this kid. And I'm like, okay, I know this is like a movie. Like who put this together? Like who assembled this? And I remember reading, oh, okay, this name, Ridley Scott. So that's the director. So the director's the person who puts it all together. And so even as a kid, I'm like, I think I want to be a director, but it started with narratives. And then later I kind of fell into documentaries, and that's when I discovered the power of the truth that I mentioned earlier. And that really kind of pulled me over.
You know, I had a chuckle in a sense when I was reading through your bio the first time, and it said somewhere in there that, and then you made a public service announcement, and I'm thinking, or a few of them, I'm thinking, wait a minute, aren't the films a public service announcement?
You're right. I mean, who says how long a PSA should be? You know, it could be 30 seconds. It could be 90 minutes. You know? So you're right. You're absolutely right.
And so with that, I thought it was interesting too. I'm trying to remember back to when I saw it years ago, but I don't know if I definitely didn't have the consciousness I have now, but who are Earthlings?
Mm. Well, so that was funny because I was trying to come up with a title for that movie, and it was, you know, that movie was about animals and particularly about the plight of animals. And I felt as I began to look at footage, I shot footage. I also licensed footage or footage I couldn't shoot myself. I got people sent me stuff. Like, for instance, I had friends in Spain who sent me some bullfighting footage because I hadn't gone to Spain to film bullfighting. So, and I remember thinking that, I'll tell you one very short story about animal cognition, and that's how the title came about. So we were at a dairy farm, a dairy facility, and they were separating a mother and calf, as they do after usually the first day. So the mother gives birth to a calf, and they'll keep the baby with the mom for a day so the baby can get the colostrum. To get a start in life. And then they'll separate the calf from the mother because they don't want the cows drinking that milk. They want to sell that product to humans. And so we're the only species on Earth who drinks milk after infancy. No other species continues to drink milk after infancy. Certainly no mammals except humans. And what's stranger still is that we drink the milk of another species. We don't drink our own. So It's a tribute to the effectiveness of the marketing of the dairy industry, really, that became so ingrained. And it's funny that it's cow. I mean, why don't we drink kangaroo milk? Why aren't we putting, you know, camel milk in our coffee, you know, or our cereal? So it started with the cows. Anyway, so we're filming this separation, and the mother is trying so hard to get through this barrier to her calf, which is completely understandable, which is there in an expression of preference. This animal is showing an expression of preference. She'd rather go here than go there. She's trying to get to her calf because it's not her first calf that was taken away, guys. It's probably her ninth. So she's been through this before. And she tries so hard to get through that barrier, she breaks her neck in the process. Her neck is broken, and they take the calf away. And I kid you not, this is the power of witnessing something, the power of the documentary. But the calf is gone. And the mother is clearly showing signs of she's grieving. Anybody with cerebral function seeing that, witnessing that, would say that's an animal that's in grief. That animal's grieving. Mm-hmm. And what's more amazing, guys, is the other cows came around to bolster her up.
Wow.
So you think about this, you think about animal cognition, how you know, and humans are just we're so extraordinary, really. You know, you think about, I mean, we can be diabolical, but we're so extraordinary with our poetry and our symphonies and our orchestrations and our mathematics, the mathematics of 60, which is how we measure time to this day, which I think the Phoenicians invented. And if you just look at, you know, our technology, I mean, our innovation, it's our symphonies. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary. And in the same breath, this sort of blind, hazy indifference to the plight of the other, which was why Unity was a follow-up to Earthlings, this no separation based on form idea, this idea of not the same, but equal. Clearly not the same, because life expresses itself so differently, but equal, or should be viewed and treated equally. And for some reason, despite our innovation and how remarkable we can be, that is still something that we struggle with to the point of that we're practically Neanderthals still in this regard. I mean, right, just at each other's throats, you know, which you see in the news on a daily basis.
That film was many years ago, and you made a remake. And I asked you, what were you feeling this many years later? And your answer surprised me.
Yeah. I mean, it was discouraging at first because the film was called Dominion. So that came out in 2018. And I was a producer on the film. It was directed by a young man named Christel Force. And he's an Australian filmmaker. And he had wanted to make a sort of updated version, if you will, of Earthlings, because Earthlings was finished in 2004, came out in 2005, and it was shot from 99 to 04, so it was in standard definition. It was not in high definition. And it's difficult with technology because the film will show its age merely because the monitors get better and better and the resolution gets higher and higher, and the lines of resolution back then are just simply not there. So the image gets muddier and muddier as we progress. So we embarked on a sort of an updated version. It was predominantly shot in Australia. That's where the access happened to be. And that was all shot in high definition. And when they first sent me footage, the very first images that were sent to me as they were gathering footage, which was from inside a pig slaughterhouse. And it looked no different than the footage we'd shot 20 years before, except it was in high definition. And I was, to be honest, I was very discouraged. I was like, we've done nothing in 20 years. We haven't moved the needle at all in 20 years. But I knew that that's not really true, because we have seen tremendous progress in other areas, certainly in the rise in plant-based foods, people being more open to trying alternative milks, for instance. I remember when Starbucks first introduced the first, I think it was a soy or an almond brand, and now you can get just about every iteration you want. There's about 17 different plant and nut milks that are available today. So we've somehow crossed this chasm from the inception of an idea, which is, in the case of milk, let's say, a non-dairy alternative that does not come from a teat, so to speak. And so you have inception and you have adoption. And in between, we call it the valley of death, which is, will something new take hold? And alternative milks have, all plant-based milks have, and the dairy industry fought it heavily. They campaigned for years. You couldn't call it milk. In Europe, they're still having that issue. You can't call it milk, because they wanted that word milk trademarked to essentially cow's milk, or the milk, which is the mammal secretions of a bovine. And that's what they wanted it to be called, as milk. Even breast milk from humans, they wanted to say, which to me is the first indication of there's great fear here. There's great fear that's coming about. It wouldn't be such an effort to shut it down. But that valley of death was crossed, and now people accept it. We are not quite there yet with alternative proteins, which is, plant-based meats, which are another innovation, and I predict another disruption, another market disruption. And it's going through that. It's in the valley of death right now. It has not made it yet to adoption. Beyond Meat had some success in 2018 with their IPO, when they launched, which I filmed at the NASDAQ. I was there to shoot that. But numbers are down on that at the moment because people are wary of this. They call it fake meat. I don't know why people call it fake meat. I think that's a derogatory term. Is your iPhone a fake Nokia? No, it's a better product. You know, it's a better smartphone than the flip phones from back then. And the fact that meat on a molecular level is made up of amino acids, lipids, trace minerals, vitamins, and water, those same five components are in plants. So instead of having a cow, for instance, which is a poor transfer device of eating grains, crops, plants, and through their skeletal muscular system and intestines, and then later being slaughtered, convert that to a piece of material that we call meat. They have come up with ways to do it. These innovators, these really masters of creation, these great innovators, to say, okay, we're going to give you all the same products you love. You know, if you want a hot dog, we got a hot dog. You want a burger, we got a burger. You want sausage, we're going to do it. And we're going to do it with plants. And it's going to take 25-fold less land for that same burger, 10-fold less water, 10-fold less agrochemicals, 10-fold less fertilizer, no management for animals and less management for crops. So it's by far better sustainably for the planet. And what you're seeing is a massive misinformation campaign, the same as milk, to shut down or just cause doubt in the consumer.
That's where I was going to go, Sean. Yeah. I feel like education is the hardest part right now, because there's so much disinformation. Mm-hmm. That the consumer is having a hard time finding out who is really authentic. Because, sure, yeah, when you're using those ingredients and the result is something that can satisfy the craving and replace those habits of the other foods, that's different than the highly overprocessed, chemical, can never be broken down, you know, marketed as food replacements that are also out there as well.
It's true. I've interviewed both the CEO of Beyond and the CEO of Impossible, Pat Brown and Ethan Brown, no relation. And neither of them have said, "Whoa, no, this isn't a carrot. We never called it a carrot. We never told you to stop eating your fruits and vegetables." You know, if, I mean, but if you're at Dodger Stadium and you want a hot dog, all right, have, if you're going to have meat, have a plant-based meat. But still eat your fruits and vegetables and your grains and your legumes, like eat healthy, you know, take care of your body. But it's a deviantly brilliant marketing campaign you know, and the fact that it's a fact that I laugh at the phenomena of it all. The fact that the meat industry is calling it processed. I mean, these are the, this is the OG of processed food, right? Bacon, sausage. I mean, the meat industry literally coined the term processed meat, deli meats and whatnot. And they're the ones slinging the term processed. It is processed, but everything's processed. It's heating, it's cooling, it's pressure. We've all been eating processed foods in one way, shape or form for a long time.
We survived, at least I survived a childhood of bologna. So
yeah, exactly.
On that note, actually, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Unity and a little bit about what's next for our guest. I want to remind everybody that if you want to go see Earthlings, or actually, for that matter, any of the films and learn more about our guest, you can go to earthlings.com. You can also go to nationearth.com. We have links for our guests on the Life Changes Show.com page. And when we come back, we are also going to have our Ask Dorothy segment. And a little later on, we're going to be joined by Luis Oliart, who will be sharing his music and his heart with us all here on the Life Changes Show Online Edition when we come back right after this.
Want to connect with amazing people who are committed to making a difference? From the Heart Tribe is a platform, community, and movement with the purpose of bringing like-minded humans together to help animals and the environment in order to gain a stronger connection and understanding of the world around us. They are dedicated to effectuating positive change by empowering individuals to organize meaningful and engaging experiences that build compassion for animals and the natural environment. Their founders and members' passion is to inspire others to actively get involved in their homes, their communities, and the world, to raise awareness about the issues we face, and most of all, to be part of the solution. Through their efforts, they have also accomplished some amazing and tangible achievements. Their Pickup for Paradise beach cleanups have collected over 50,000 pieces of foreign debris. And also, thanks to animal rescue and recovery volunteers, over 30% of the volunteers have become vegan or reduced their meat intake. Daily habits make a big difference. Please join any of their upcoming events by going to fthtt.org and signing up for their newsletter. You can also follow on Instagram and Facebook at From the Heart Tribe. Have you felt inspired to meditate but you just can't? Do you suffer from anxiety but fidget toys just make you more fidgety? Want to replace negative self-talk in your head that keeps bringing you down? Introducing the latest self-help solution, Phi Beads. Transformational beaded jewelry inspired by ancient wisdom, science, math, and psychology. All Phi beads are designed to incorporate the powerful Fibonacci sequence, nature's mathematical formula that has shaped our existence from the beginning of time. The Fibonacci sequence, also known as the golden mean or the golden ratio, is recognized by our conscious and unconscious mind and resonates as order out of chaos, like we see in plants, flowers, seashells, ocean waves, the pyramids, and in our own body. Not only beautiful, they feel good to wear. Phi beads can help anchor tranquility, positivity, focus, and structure in your life by doing the Phi meditation. Phi meditation helps you harness the power of I am for intention, affirmation, and manifestation. Affirm the life you want. Get your set of Phi beads at phibeads.com. That's Phi, P-H-I, beads.com.
You are listening to A Conversation That Matters on The Life Changes Show. Broadcasting live from the heart of Los Angeles every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Share the journey with us at lifechangesshow.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Life Changes Show.
We're back. I'm Philippe. Our guest is writer, director, and producer of documentary films, including Earthlings and Unity, and Sean Monson. And we have had, we actually list the video of Sean introducing Unity, and more specifically, why Unity. And he does a really passionate job in that video. I'm just going to summarize a couple of his words. Despite the advent of science, literature, culture, technology, philosophy, religion, and so on, none of these have assuaged humankind from killing one another, the animals, and nature. Like, wow, Sean.
Well, yeah, don't shoot the messenger. I mean, I'm just documenting the human condition in all of its forms, because, you know, going back to the last century or World War II, it's very interesting that someone like Gandhi and Hitler were contemporaries. I find that very interesting that in the same span of a lifetime, you could see two different calibrations of human consciousness, if you will, one calibrating much higher and one calibrating much lower than the other, yet both in the human condition. So there seems to be this range and the free will of choice to either move oneself up or down this range. In what other place? It's probably, and I'm drifting into spirituality here a little, but that's okay. But it's probably, this world is probably the perfect place for ultimate karmic growth, because you're in such a realm of tremendous negativity, and to elevate oneself through a obstacle course like that may be one of the most ideal obstacle courses, as it were. In the same breath, I work a lot with animals, as we've discussed, but my younger sister has an organization that fights human trafficking. And when she tells me stories of things that happened, I have no words for it. Yeah, it would never enter the mind, you would think, to do the things that people do to children, sexually and otherwise. So yes, this may be an ideal realm for maximum karmic growth in a spiritual sense, but also for those that are suffering, confused, don't know what they've done wrong, like the animals, this sort of hostility and aggression. It seems unmotivated, unfounded. What have they done to deserve this? And if there is an animal cognition, one wonders if they don't reflect or wonder. If a cow can grieve over the loss of her calf, can she wonder why she's being treated a certain way? I don't know. But I wish humans explored animal cognition more than they do.
You, in our conversation, took me down many different paths. You made me remember I was an extra in a big A-budget movie, and I remember at one point that after one particular scene was done, they had to clear the set and set up for something else, and there were all these big potted plants and big potted trees, and they took these plants and they just threw them in a pile because they were done with them. And I thought, what are they doing to the plants? Like, why can't they place them over there and then, you know, give them another life after this? Like, what's going to happen to those poor plants? And that's plants. And in talking with you, you were saying it wasn't until very recently that what?
Oh, you mean it wasn't very recently that, just so I follow your line of questioning.
That, yeah, it wasn't until very recently that they were doing that with animals.
People and animals, yeah. And go back a little further and they did it with people. Yeah.
Oh.
Some places.
Really?
Well, life unworthy of life, right? So.
Wow.
If you go back to the World War II, you're literally, Hitler didn't understand that. Hitler didn't understand the planet he lived on. In a planet with this type of multitudinous life forms, it's like he wanted to get rid of a certain kind of flower or a certain type of bird, you know, by eradicating Jews or homosexuals or gypsies or whomever he perceived as worthy of aggression, life unworthy of life. And you see that same symbolism in either the treatment of animals or the treatment of the trees and the plants on a movie set, you know. I mean, I was just involved with, I know we're getting at the bottom of the hour, but I was just involved in this. I'm an advisor on this project for this orca named Lolita that was in Miami. She just died. You may have heard about it just in the last month, this orca at the Miami Sea Aquarium. Her name was Lolita. And all year we've been working on her release, and we found this wonderful donor named Jim Irsay, who happens to be the owner of the Indianapolis Colts, you know, football team. And he he'd heard about Lolita and he made it one of his missions in life to get her out of there. And the CEO, the owner of the Seaquarium, which was purchased by somebody else during COVID, a new group called the Dolphin Company, and that CEO, Eduardo, agreed. Okay, it's time. It's time. And just some context is, you know, female orcas can live 80 to 100 years in the wild. The males, maybe 50 years, 50 to 80, but the female is 80 to 100 years in the wild. And when she was captured, when Lolita was captured off Puget Sound in August of 1970, she was 4 years old. So she, you know, orcas stay with their pods for life, their families for life. She already could communicate with her pod. She already could fish for herself. And that's when she was captured and she was sold to the Seaquarium. And orcas swim 75 to 100 miles every single day. So to take an animal like this and put her in an 80 foot by 40 foot pool, 20 feet deep, for 52 years, 53. She entered those waters in September this month, 53 years ago. She just died a few weeks ago. All of the other orcas that had been captured at that time, they can't capture them anymore, they're endangered, but at the time in Sultan Rain Parks, they've all since died in captivity. Some of them committed suicide, they believe. They'd ram their heads against the side of the pool, or they'd roll over and open their blowholes and drown themselves because they couldn't take it for a creature that swims 75 to 100 miles a day and is very social to live in isolation in an 85, 40-foot pool. But Lolita had tremendous resilience. And I'll tell you something else about her pod, because her mother is still alive because she's tagged and they track her. They return to that same area, guys, every year, and her mother calls for her. She's been doing that for 53 years. We don't understand animal cognition. It's a great crime. It could be that humans have developed a tremendous amount of negative karma for our obstinance in understanding these other creatures, these other earthlings, as it were. And that's what I try to highlight in some of the film that I work on.
Sean, we were talking about, or you were reflecting about how you felt like, you know, how much have we moved the needle and how much have you accomplished? But, you know, in listening to you talk and thinking, having experienced your films, listening to the message that you carry forward, and having spoke with so many that also have, I truly believe that you have made a greater impression on the psychology and the reprogramming, the awareness of animal cognition and of deprogramming the marketing and the disconnect that products have made, you know, the meat products or the food sources. So the people, you know, your movies, what struck me the most was how much you humanized every species and we could connect with them. And the minute you do that, you look at everything differently.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I mean, if you're going to do something, assemble a piece and put it together and work on it, you hope it has a positive effect. You hope it has a positive effect.
Well, we know it has, and it was actually a question that I had for you as we're bringing this great conversation to a close, that you are one person, and look at what one person has done with this support, or it's hard to say support, because you've also had the other kind of people trying to stop it, right? So it's like, how do you balance that out? But so obviously you can't do the whole thing by yourself, but you're one person and you've done this, and we are each individually one person. Collectively we can do more, but even as one person, you said there are things we could do, and you give those kinds of recommendations real quickly. Can you add to the conversation with some
like the Buddha quote earlier, you know, the greatest miracle in the world is to change a single thought. Okay. So every time you encounter somebody, every time you interface with somebody, and you may cross paths with somebody, and it's the only time you're ever going to see them again in this lifetime. Just this one fleeting few seconds or minutes. Again, you know, we don't want to, it's tricky. It's dodgy one. You know, you don't want to proselyte. You don't want to necessarily be proselyting. You want to attract more than proselyte. But you also don't want to have a negative effect. You want to have a positive effect. I meet lots of passionate animal advocates, activists who are angry and hurt, usually after seeing, ironically, one of my one of my films. So they're all worked up because it's so horrific, you know, and they're just like angry. That's a natural response. But it's not a very effective teaching tool. It's not an attractive teaching tool. If you're in a therapist with you and your partner and a therapist and you're arguing and the walls come up, they'll immediately stop that right away because no communication, no learning can happen. So we have to treat every moment that we cross paths with somebody as a sacred moment, if you will, and really, really listen to them just for a minute, just to pick up on their sense of vibration. And then in that moment, I joked about this earlier, like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, you know, you try something, okay, crash and burn, that didn't work. Right. Note to self, you know, you try it again, crash and burn. But we don't have a lot of crash and burns with each person, each impression we leave on somebody. So I think the best thing to do is, if you can, personal practice is to do your absolute best to intuit the person you're interfacing with. And in that moment of intuiting it, the words or the thought or the energy might come of the one seed that you can plant. And I think of all activists as gardeners, constantly casting seeds. Some seeds land on stony ground and some land on rich, fertile soil. But we must keep casting these seeds, you know, we must keep casting these seeds. So that's, I guess, my answer to your question on that one.
Oh, it sure does. We didn't get to talk about the deer of Catalina. There's so much, actually. Go to earthlings.com and nationearth.com, and you can find a lot more information also at lifechangesshow.com for our guest, Sean Monson. Sean, this has been a sacred moment with you, and thank you very much for coming on and sharing with us. And it feels like you've got so much going on. It feels like the first of many, and I look forward to that.
Thank you for having me. Thank you again.
Sean, a true pleasure. And with that, we have our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Maria from New Jersey, and I took your energetic alchemy workshop years ago, and it really helped me greatly. I now have a healing practice, and I'm getting great results with my clients. During my time with you in the workshop, I noticed that you always express happiness, even when you discuss the trauma and drama of your past. You laughed when you described your former way of being, when how you felt you were a victim. I'm not happy and I want to be more like you. How do I accomplish being happy in today's crazy world?
Dear Maria, thank you for this timely question. As I shared with you, my belief is that happiness is a choice and one that we must consciously and consistently make. I start my day with declaring that I am happy and that I will choose to find the gifts in everything that occurs during the day. I highly recommend a wonderful list that Carl Moore gives in his book, The 18 Rules of Happiness. I'm sharing the short form of his list with you here. 1, stop feeling sorry for yourself. 2, be grateful. 3, say yes more. 4, follow your bliss. 5, learn to let go. 6, do random acts of kindness. 7, happiness is only ever now. 8, experience, don't hoard. 9, appreciate both sides of the coin. 10, be more social. 11, love more. 12, have a dream. 13, intention sets direction. 14, enjoy simple pleasures. 15, accept what is. 16, exercise and eat well. 17, zoom out and don't sweat. And 18, laugh, dance, smile. I trust that this list will inspire you to check out Carl Moore's book, which is available online, and I feel you will find the many ways you can create happiness on a daily basis.
I think 21 was dance and do sweat, but thank you, Dorothy. If you have a question for Dorothy, please write her at askdorothy@lifechangesshow.com.
And we'll be right back with our performance guest, Luis Oliart, here on the Life Changes Show Online Edition, right after this.
The Little Dog That Could is the fantastically true story of a man and a little dog that came into his life as his mentor to help him understand the world beyond his human senses and to experience life, love, and healing beyond his human understanding. Best-selling author Filippo Voltaggio, who currently hosts the highly regarded Life Changes show, is an internationally known singer, speaker, and life coach. Filippo offers up his own story, how one little surprise package in fur and four legs transformed his life unexpectedly forever and furthered his path of self-discovery. In The Little Dog That Could, Filippo brings to life the meaning of the adage, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Through the reading of this book, you will experience the journey of real miracles that transcend time, space, and logic while gaining practical tools that will help you navigate your way. The Little Dog That Could is available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. For more information, visit thelittledogthatcould.com. That's thelittledogthatcould.com.
There are self-help seminars costing thousands of dollars guaranteeing miraculous transformations. There are compelling speakers and life-changing weekend experiences where you can walk on fire. They all deliver revelations that guarantee you'll come back for the more expensive revelations filled with even greater wonder next month on Fiji. We get addicted to positive, heartfelt, expensive theater. What we really need is a jumpstart, an awakening, someone who can give us a reminder that everything we need lies within. Through inspiration and practical knowledge, Dorothy Donahue helps people get grounded and motivated, inspired and energized. It's not just words and affirmations and the power of intention. It's a mindset brought about by a tangible, transcendental experience, an audio-visual, physical, spiritual experience that helps us realize we transform ourselves. We get tools to become the conscious co-creators of lives of unlimited potential. Find out more. Go to DorothyDonahue.com.
You are listening to A Conversation That Matters on The Life Changes Show. Broadcasting live from the heart of Los Angeles every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Share the journey with us at lifechangesshow.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Life Changes Show.
We're back. I am Filippo, and our performance guest is a singer, songwriter, producer, guitarist, and Mesa Blue Moon recording artist, Luis Oliart. Welcome, Luis, to the Life Changes Show.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it is our pleasure. And thank you. We know you are really busy. You've had a lot going on. You just released last month or a month and a half ago a huge single. And then just this past Friday, another huge single. And tomorrow you're playing a huge event at the, or well, your band's playing at the Mint here in Los Angeles. You've got so much going on. And tonight you're joining us. And you took time to blow me away today in our conversation.
Well, you took the time to ask me some questions that I was actually taken back a bit by the whole experience. It's great. It was great.
How much of it do we want to share with our audience? Because it's been with me all day.
Literally. Well, ask away.
I was feeling something and I asked you about music as a child and you went right in and all you had to say was Latchkey and all of a sudden I'm like, wow, where's this going?
Well, you'd asked me, you know, I mean, I'm a professional musician since I was 12 and I'm, you know, been doing this decades and decades now, and I'm still in business, so that's a good sign of measurable accomplishment in Los Angeles and all that. So I'm proud of that, you know, and I've lived pretty much as an artist, raised my son who's a college graduate and everything. But you'd asked about why I got into it or whatever, and it was really just being a latchkey kid, and I did okay in school, so I really wasn't struggling with my schoolwork, you know. I had decent intelligence and stuff, so I did okay, and then I would just need something to do, and so I was a bass player only back then, and I just would be hanging. All of a sudden, I found community. I was with these Adonis looking guys, and I was this little dude, you know, in like seventh grade and middle school. And next thing I know, I'm playing, you know, David Bowie and Generation X and Dead Kennedy songs at this party. And then I'm at this, you know, playing Deep Purple and Hendrix and Led Zeppelin over there. And then, you know, it's the 80s and then you're playing in the pop bands. So it just kind of wherever music was, I just kind of went as a bass player and hit my mark and hadn't really developed my own identity, but I was just basically immersed in a lot of music. I wasn't particularly the most talented guy in the room, but I had a good work ethic, and I did love playing music. I love the escape in it, I think. So it was more therapeutic as a driver. And I wasn't particularly educated in it. Played heavy metal, you know, and back in the day, Bill Gazzari and all those, you know, bands were doing well, and Motley Crue and the Quiet Riot and that heyday of rock and roll. So it just kind of saved me, you know.
And so, I was thinking as you started your story about it, the after school program, sports and theater and music and all it, when those aren't available, and even sometimes when they are, it's easy for kids, especially in latchkey situations, to end up in gangs or on drugs or in the streets or something. Music has saved so many. It has been part of your life, and you've gone on to help so many with your music, and that's where I lost it. Like, tell us about that.
Well, I think when you'd asked me about it, it was really more about adaptability, and I didn't really, I wasn't conscious of it, but as life went on, I've done a lot of things outside of music to help, just out of necessity. I still do, you know, on a church campus where I was security, where just the alarms and things like that, and just to protect the people and the properties as life changed. And I don't walk around in a uniform or anything. I just live there. And if there's a problem, they call me. But it's because I've always been able to adapt and talk to people. When I was on the road, you know, and the car would break down in the snow, I would walk up to the trucker and say, "Hey, man, our lights aren't working. I got 50 miles to the gig. You drive behind me and I'll drive in front of you. And we're in the middle of Iowa storm, and you'll get us there. Okay." And, you know, of course he got us there, and we got a ticket on the way off the off ramp, and we got there, and, you know, we made that $8 at that gig, man. But, you know, but I got us there. And that resourcefulness, I just think, trained me to do other things in life. Because as a musician, you've got to be, especially when you're improvising and, you know, it's the ultimate team effort and back and forth. And those kinds of things I find more interesting about music than maybe the rock and roll lifestyle. Though I have guys that I'm with and around that are far more rock star guys than I am, but they are my friends, you know. And I think that's why we get along, because it's just we offset each other a little bit, you know.
Well, with famous names like the Troubadour and Carnegie Hall, of course, House of Blues, Knitting Factory, Hard Rock Cafe, BB King's, you and with so many of the people that you've worked with and opened for and da 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 da, we ended up like that didn't even come up. We ended up talking about children in hospitals and people with handicaps.
Well, that part of it, you know, I play bass and I play acoustic guitar, and I got pretty good at the acoustic, especially when I was doing like the singles kind of a circuit. You know, I'd gone to Europe and the American in the bar, you know, without the phonetic linguistic. I had the accent because I was an American, so I'd sing rock and roll songs. And so I got pretty good on that acoustic, and so I could do like sweet finger picking things and stuff that was, you know, it was comforting, it was soothing, music like that. So I landed and was recommended to play these bedside tours through Art of Elysium. So most of the LA hospitals, just like once a month, I did it a lot more, you know, but for about 15 years, I've played from Cedars to Children's Hospitals to Kaiser, you know, all those hospitals on that Sunset Strip. Not far from the rock and roll, but then down a ways through Tide, you know, over there where all those hospitals are, I would go once a month. And my career, I'd always back people up and I'd done okay. And I'd always release songs on my own. But once I started doing the hospital gigs, and I'm not trying to sound all far out on you, you know, fellas, I've lived on a church and been around all kinds of interfaith efforts and things like that. So I'm around a lots of religion and spiritual people, but there was just something about walking into a room when there was, let's say, a sick kid. And sometimes it's eminent, sometimes it's just a broken arm, but you're most of the time you're playing for the parents, you know, and you don't go in. I didn't go in there and go, you know, hi and oh, everything's going to be. You just go in and you hit your mark and you play whatever you think's appropriate, so the moms and dads can escape, or the family or the kid can escape for a second, and then you just go. But there was something for me personally, and that was kind of stripped your pretense, because no one really gives a, it's not the language, I'm going to keep it clean, but
thank
the rats took us about, you know, you and who you've played with and this, this, and that when their child is sick. You know what I mean? It's, yeah. It's just really not at the top of anybody's priority list right there. You could see it in their faces, you know? So you just kind of went in there and you really just never phoned it in. I really never did. I had some days that were better than others, for sure, where I played better than others, but I honestly never phoned it in and held that. And it got to the point where they were taking me into like the ICU areas where it was clearance. And sometimes you'd have to mask up. Sometimes you'd have to, they'd suit you up to even go into certain places and play. And then I got a call, you know, maybe a week after I'd done my last tour, and it was from the head nurse. And these people are very busy people. And she thanked me in particular for one child that was on life support and was really, really struggling. And their passing was imminent, you know, and their condition was imminent. And she just said, you know, we'd been working, struggling with the baby the whole day, and you played and the breathing calmed. And she mellowed, and she said, and she passed peacefully. So we, the nurses all wanted to thank you for that. And I got to tell you, man, I just, you know, like I said, I've played Carnegie Hall. I've done some amazing things, people cheering, everything that your moms and dads and, you know, family would be proudest of. But I got to tell you, that was probably one of the more purposeful, you know, at the end of the day, when we're all, it's over. I just thought that kind of playing really contributed something back, you know, for me. And because of that, then it was later in life I got signed. And I'm not saying it was all due to some epiphany, but I just think it shifted my priorities. And because of that, I was a better performer. More people would come hear me play because they'd like the energy coming off the stage. I'm not sure, but there was a correlation when I started doing that.
Louise, I'm not your mom or dad or your brother or cousin. I don't even know you, but I'm proud of you. And I know you haven't shared this on air before, so thank you for sharing it with us. And before I really lose it, we're going to hear some music. Ironically, this one's called Sad and Lonely.
Well, let me set that up so I can sound like, because I sound like some music therapy guy, which I guess I am in some degree, but this was... I used to spend like 6 months on the road, you know, with a band called the Wild Cards. We were signed with Chameleon Records, and John Lee Hooker was on the label. And it would be like 6 months on the road in a van, and we take shifts and do national tours, you know. And you'd have relationships, you know. I was single and I was doing my thing, and after a while, you know, you'd be in Georgia and you'd call this girl, and then you go back to Georgia and you'd be calling her again. But after a year or two of that, you know, how far can the relationship go, really? And that's kind of what the tune was about. But I always managed to have like some sort of respectful where we never really were together, but we kind of broke up peacefully because generally she would find someone that cared for her and could fulfill, you know, a long-term committed relationship. But so the tune really comes from me looking in the mirror, or the other person could be looking in the mirror as far as the perspective.
Well, this is special too, because it was just released on Friday, right? So
yeah,
we have Luis Oliart's just released song, pre-recorded here on the Life Changes Show, Sad and Lonely.
Never really knew what was fair. Never
Wanted to let that bass sound die out peacefully. Didn't want to interrupt that. Luis Oliart, that is his new single that just came out. And want to learn more about him? Go to Luis Oliart. It's spelled LuisOliart.com. And he's on social media actually as Luis Oliart or Luis.Oliart or Oliart Rocks. Find all those links at lifechangesshow.com. You do rock, Luis. You
thank you. I've been a solo artist for a long time, but I have a band now, so it's Luis Oliart, just because that's who I'm signed with the label. But that's my band, The Hinges.
Right.
And so that's if I can, Norwood Fisher, the founder of Fishbone, and John Stewart, the drummer. So the bassist and drummer for Fishbone are the rhythm section of the band, and Jay O'Keefe, a great second guitar player, and Chuck Boogie is on keyboards, and Chuck is hip-hop music. He played in Far Side and Slang and groups like that. He has an organ trio. He's just a tremendous keyboard player. And as far as the new record that'll be coming out in 2024, which is recorded, we're mixing all that now, Chuck is the other main writing spring for the band.
And you'll be able to hear Luis Oliart and The Hinge live tomorrow at the Mint. And if people follow you at any of these links, they'll learn about other upcoming events and shows and things like that, right?
Absolutely.
So I loved this. Real quickly before we go on to the next song, and we bring our amazing show, this has been amazing with the two of you, to a close. I read a quote. Let's see, where did I read it? Although he's a talented multi-instrumentalist, said Bernard Bauer from Music Connection, often identified with his electric, acoustic, and dobro guitar wizardry, Luis has gotten rave reviews for his vocal chops and songwriting skills, which you just heard. Now, this is all self-taught, right, Luis?
Yeah, for the most part. And then later on, I had some really good mentors around me. And then even later than that, somebody said, "You're going to be the teacher of my child." I taught at a music camp, and all these affluent families said, "No, you will teach my child." And that was like 20 years ago. So a lot of the reasons through the hardships of being an artist, I was a teacher, and I had to go and educate myself quickly, you know, and so I could communicate the system of music. And then, you know, being a working musician, that's the work ethic part that you can teach. But I have a whole, you know, a roster of kids that have gone on to higher learning in music, and some not so much. Like, I get all the misfit toys. Some have had schizophrenia, some you know, just have struggle in school and things like that. I get all the strange ones, but they're wonderfully unique. And I've always been able to kind of, what we talked about, adapt and connect and make it work, you know, help
and,
them.
And we don't always know what support we're actually giving them. It might have little to do with actually learning music, but through music, through an instrument, through what you're doing, obviously you support. That's what I'm getting. So thank you for that as well. So we're going to get to hear a song. Now, this came out like a month and a half ago. Now, you're not apologizing for the fact that this is pop-ish or rock pop-ish or...
No. Or, but it's pretty... Well, I wrote it because I wrote it with Annabelle Chick. She was a student of mine, and she went off to Tulane and came back and says, "I miss when we used to jam." And she says, "What do you have?" And I said, "I have this piece." And so we wrote that. She came back from college, a former student, and we wrote this piece together. And, you know, I like, you know, a lot of black music. And so when I say that, I mean, like, from the King Sonny Adade, who's on my label, or the African music where the sound is more jubilation. And even though the riffing is kind of the same as the blues in America, there is a transition where it's coming more from a community of oppression or making a living, and that, especially that early 70s Chicago politically charged edge with Freddie King and stuff. And so this tune kind of, I wanted to go back to more of the African sound of the blues, and you'll hear that in the guitar playing, but it also has, you know, the edge. And then David Ralicky, a brilliant sax player, who's kind of an extended Hinge, and he did the horn arrangements on it.
Well, we're going to get to hear it now. This is Hold On to Your Love, and it is pre-recorded. Is this also the Hinge, or is this...
These are the two singles that we did in my home studio. I had to put it all together because the guys were touring. But this next record, we were for 2 days in the studio live, and that'll be a cool, different sound on 1-inch analog tape. So these two I recorded over the last 6 months.
Well, we look forward to that. But in the meantime, we have this. This is pre-recorded, Luis Oliart and The Hinge, and Hold On to Your Love here on the Life Changers Show.
Never the two shall part. together we'll go far.
Luis Oliart and The Hinge. Find out more about him by going, and the band for that matter, by going to Luis Oliart. Again, LuisOliart.com. Luis Oliart. Again, we have links for him, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Find them at Life Changes Show. And Luis is... I just want to make sure before we go that I get this right. I don't think I said this. Is it Hold On To Our Love?
Yeah, Hold On To Our Love.
Our Love. Okay. All right. I also heard My Love in there. And so I'm like, okay, well, which is it? So it's Our Love, but it's love. It's love. And loved it. Thank you so much for sharing your music with us, sharing your stories and your heart, and all the best to you all. Is there a band website directly we should also mention?
No, just go to my site, and it all has Luis Oliart and The Hinges on there. So it's all there. But thank you so much for having me. I mean, just the general theme of this show, I appreciate it. It's who I am, and it's nice to hear others that share.
We're in this together.
We're in this together, which is what that song's about, really. Stick together.
Yes, yes, indeed. No More Sad and Lonely, although that's a good song. You listen to it, enjoy it, but let's hold on to our love, and Thank you so much, Luis. All the best to you. I look forward to enjoying you and the Hinge live someday. In the meantime, all the best. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Have a great night. Bye-bye.
And with that, big thank you to Luis Oliart, and another big thank you to our guest, Sean Monson. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark Lejeur, I am Filippo Voltaggio, your host, reminding you that as your life changes like ours surely did tonight, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at the Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.